My name is Dr. John Blumenstein. The course is New Testament Theology. This is cassette number 3, side A. We now begin to look at each writing individually and attempt to explore the theological nature of each of these writings in order to appreciate them more as theological writings, but always on their own term. Respecting the structure of the New Testament canon, we begin with the Gospel of Matthew. Now, we always want to ask, what is the best way to approach the material in a manner consistent with the inherent nature of the material, consistent with the inherent nature of each one of these writings? Allow me to give you something of an overview of what you will find in each lecture on each writing. Will be patterned roughly according to the same pattern. First, we will look at the place of that writing in the New Testament canon. We'll ask questions related to its place within the canon and how it stands alongside other writings of the canon. We'll ask about its canonical function. What sorts of distinctive contributions does it make to the canon? And as appropriate, we will look from time to time at the history of a particular writing in the canon, its canonical history, both ancient and modern. From time to time, we will explore the background of a writing as appropriate to our understanding of the theological nature of the writing. Most of the time, however, we will not be delving much into background issues, leaving those for the purposes of New Testament synthesis survey courses. We will, for each writing, look at the overall theological structure and style of the writing. We want to appreciate these writings theologically in the form in which they come to us. So we will look at overall structure and look at pervasive stylistic features related to these writings insofar as these give us insight into the nature of these writings, theologically speaking. Next, we wish to explore the distinctive theological idiom and voice of each writing. Here we will go more deeply into some of the particulars associated with the doctrine that is found in the writings and the kinds of emphases which are there. And then from time to time, we will look at a particular text and try to illustrate in an exegetical way what we are talking about in our exploration of the theological nature of these writings and try to suggest all along how our theological investigation can come to life exegetically in the preaching and teaching ministry of the church today and our witness today in the world. Now we're going to give a relatively heavy emphasis to the Gospel of Matthew, assuming because of its of similarities between it and Matthew and Luke that a great deal of overlap will occur. Much of what we say here, therefore, will apply throughout the Gospels. And so for each one, as we come to them, Mark and Luke, and ultimately John, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. Matthew, because it comes first in the canon by default, serves as our benchmark on the basis of which we see in sharper relief the relative distinctiveness of the other two Gospels. Our purpose is to discover the distinctive theological voice of each writing, but not to overplay the distinctives such that we lose sight of what they present as a common witness to the one person and ministry of Jesus Christ. First, let's take a look at the place of the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament canon. Structurally, it comes first, quite obviously. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In some ways, practically, it comes first in the history of the canon. There aren't any canon controversies that I know of associated with the Gospel of Matthew in the time of the early church. Apparently it was accepted early on, and there weren't any controversies associated with it, at least on the order of that associated with the book of James, for example. Listen to what D.A. Carson has to say in his commentary on the Gospel of Matthew, page 19. During the first 3 centuries of the church, Matthew was the most highly revered and frequently quoted canonical gospel, end quote. Listen also to the voice of of Luke Timothy Johnson in his work, The Writings of the New Testament, page 172. So far as ecclesial use is concerned, Matthew is the most successful edition of Mark's gospel. End quote. Well, it's probably easy to see why Matthew proved itself early on to be a very useful gospel in the life of the church. There's a relatively high concentration of explicit ethical pastoral instruction in this gospel. We can think of the Sermon on the Mount, chapters 5, 6, and 7, and the systematic way in which so much subject matter is treated in that sermon, and the various blocks of discourse that we find in the Gospel of Matthew, the discourse on discipleship in the 10th chapter, the parables in the 13th chapter, further discourse on discipleship, and more specifically, life and ministry in the church, church discipline and such, in the 18th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, and the tremendous block of teaching which comes to us in the 23rd, 24th, and 25th chapters of the Gospel of Matthew. The arrangement of the material itself, the orderly arrangement of the material, has only enhanced the usefulness of the Gospel of Matthew in the ministry of the church. There's a recurring cycle of narrative and discourse throughout the Gospel of Matthew. Johnson, in his work, The Writings of the New Testament, page 174, says the discourse material in Matthew is in sum characterized by fullness, order, and symmetry. End quote. And of course, the Gospel of Matthew addresses a number of issues that were close to the heart of believers in the early church and have been close to the heart of believers throughout centuries of church history. But for the early church, the whole question of the relationship between Christians and Jews was a significant question, and this question is addressed in some explicit and less explicit or more subtle ways in the Gospel of Matthew, with the emphasis upon the Gentiles in this gospel, upon Abraham in the genealogy and such, and the Great Commission to disciple the nations, which comes at the end of the gospel. There was also an ancient belief in the priority of the Gospel of Matthew, that it was written first, that it came first, and this certainly helped its position along. Now, let's take a look next at the overall theological structure and style of this gospel, and explore just a bit what all is there in the way of a kind of structural overview of the gospel, for what this can tell us about what makes this gospel tick theologically. I believe that scholars have searched in vain for a particular cue that unlocks for us a secret to the structure of the Gospel of Matthew. There have been two ways, broadly speaking, in which scholars have tried to approach the issue of the structure of this gospel. There's the five-fold scheme adopted by B.W. Bacon and many other scholars of the Gospel of Matthew, which sees the structural key to this gospel found in the expression in the Greek text, consistently used, and it comes across consistently in most English translations. And when Jesus finished these sayings, we find the first occurrence of this at chapter 7, verse 28. The recurrence of that expression in the text, when Jesus finished these sayings, for many scholars, provides a structural cue that blocks off five cycles of material to give us a kind of five-fold book structure to the Gospel of Matthew, or chapters or sections, whatever you would call it. and the way these structural cues play out, when you look at the occurrences of the various ones of them, they seem to mark off discrete sections in the Gospel of Matthew, which involve, on the one hand, narrative material, story and record of Jesus' ministry and movement and action, and then on the other hand, discourse material. The narrative material comes first, and then it's followed by a block of discourse material. the first occurrence of the phrase at Matthew 7, verse 28, would mark off the first block as beginning with chapter 3, verse 1. Chapters 3 and 4 would constitute narrative. Chapters 5, 6, and 7 would then constitute discourse, the well-known Sermon on the Mount, and then followed by chapters 8 and 9 constituting narrative, and then chapter 10 constituting discourse material, and then at the end of chapter 10, beginning of chapter 11, you have the second occurrence of the phrase, and when Jesus had finished, and then so on. Chapter 11, narrative material, and so on and so forth. The cycle goes there from narrative to discourse, cycles within these five blocks of material. Once you have identified these five occurrences of the phrase, when Jesus had finished. There's also the threefold scheme that Dr. Jack Dean Kingsbury has identifies in his writings along with others and makes a great deal of use of. It's the recurrence of an expression, and from that time, from then or from that point, Jesus did such and such and thus and so. This expression occurs at 4:17 and 16:21, and Kingsbury thereby sees a kind of threefold scheme to the Gospel of Matthew, but for Kingsbury as a narrative critical scholar, he's not inclined to see these as three blocks, but as three sections constituting one whole narrative movement with distinctive emphases characteristic of each section. I prefer, based upon my own study of the Gospel of Matthew, not to think too rigidly about this matter of structure, not to look for cues and secrets to the structure of the Gospel of Matthew. I am much more inclined to look at it as a whole narrative and to treat it as a whole narrative, as suggested by our exegesis in the earlier lecture of the crucifixion narrative, treating the Gospel of Matthew as a whole narrative unit and the individual text within it as part of that whole, looking at everything in the context of the whole. I do believe that there are certain structural thematic cues that give us insight into something of what makes this gospel tick as a whole, theologically speaking. I think we get insight into this by looking at what we find almost bracketing the gospel, as it were, in the first chapter and in the 28th chapter. In the first chapter, you might recall, and you can look at this, the explanation for a couple of names for Jesus, the name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. That's the explanation given in 1:21. And then the name Emmanuel, which means God with us. At the outset of the Gospel of Matthew, following the genealogy, is a strong emphasis upon Jesus as Savior and also as God with us. And then at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, there's a kind of echoing, I believe, of this emphasis at the very end of the Gospel, when Jesus, following his resurrection from the dead, declares to the disciples or promises them, "And lo, I am with you always, to the close of the age." And then within the Gospel itself, you find testimony to this emphasis upon the presence of God in Jesus. The 18th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, following some instructions, in verse 20, Jesus says, "For where two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst of them." And the expression "in the midst" echoes Old Testament expression related to God being in the midst of his people. There's a definite emphasis upon the presence of God in Jesus through this language. And you've got it emphasized at the beginning of the Gospel, the promise of Jesus' presence at the end of the Gospel. All of this, of course, is nuanced by Jesus' saving mission, the fact that he will save his people from their sins. So the presence of God is understood to be saving, redeeming presence all the way throughout. So what I believe you have going on here is a presentation of Jesus which portrays his person and work with a strong accent upon the saving, redeeming presence of God, active in the ministry of Jesus. In Jesus, Son of God and Son of Man, God is present, establishing his reign through the very person and ministry of Jesus. The redeeming presence of God in Jesus is announced prior to the birth of Jesus, and then is affirmed in numerous ways during Jesus' earthly ministry, and is affirmed after Jesus' resurrection from the dead. There are numerous subtle nuances associated with Matthew's portrait of Jesus and of discipleship within this broad frame of reference, which emphasizes God's saving and redeeming presence active in the person and ministry of Jesus. Now, the dramatic development of Matthew is much slower than that found in Mark's relatively rapid pace narrative. Luke Timothy Johnson, in his work, The Writings of the New Testament, calls Matthew a much slower and sometimes even a distracted, dramatic development. You do have these blocks of material that we talked about, and some of the other ways of structuring, some of the ways we've talked about structuring the Gospel of Matthew are helpful up to a point. I would always caution against pushing those structures too far versus simply treating the gospel as a whole and looking for cues and recurrent emphases. And what I believe especially is significant in the way of how this gospel begins its presentation of Jesus and how it ends its presentation of Jesus, with a strong accent upon the presence of God, the redeeming presence of God in the person and ministry of Jesus. Now, what we wish to do, having explored something of the overall theological structure and style of the Gospel of Matthew, we want to focus in particular upon some of the distinctive theological idiom of this Gospel, some of the distinctive theological language characteristic of the Gospel of Matthew. We've talked about the ground rules for our approach to the theology of the Gospels. I think, indeed, you can have too much proliferation of theological categories when it comes to appreciating the Gospels theologically. We want to stay very close to them as narratives in their canonical form in our theological treatment of the New Testament. And the two broad categories that we will work within are the categories of Christology and discipleship, two categories that I believe are very close to the inherent nature of the material that we are working with. And, of course, there are various interrelated themes that can be treated under each of these broad categories, and these two categories in themselves, as we've already seen, are very closely intertwined. Discipleship is not possible without Christology. Christology is presented not in an abstract way, but so as to evoke human response, to encourage discipleship, to bring people to discipleship. Christology sets the shape for discipleship. And all discipleship is, in some sense or another, a response to the person and work of Christ. In the case of the Gospel of Matthew, we begin with Christology, and with each one of these Gospels, because they have some distinctive character about them, we might slice the pie a little bit differently according to the nature and the form of that particular Gospel. But with the Gospel of Matthew, we can easily talk about titles. We can also look at the titles given to Jesus under Christology. We can look at Jesus' activity in the Gospel of Matthew. And then finally, we can look a bit at some themes, recurrent themes that give us insight into the Christology of this Gospel. Well, we begin with titles. We've already talked about a title in connection with our exegetical treatment of the crucifixion narrative, the title Son of God. Matthew does present Jesus strongly and pervasively as the Son of God. Yet all of this is, as we've already seen, heavily nuanced by the outcome of Jesus' life and ministry. He is presented as the obedient Son, one who is gentle, one whose ministry entails not a triumphant wielding of power, but a humble ministry of service. Jesus is the ideal son Israel was called to be. At the outset of the Gospel of Matthew, you find this strong emphasis upon Jesus as kind of the ideal son of Israel. He ends up in Egypt. You read in the birth narrative perhaps a kind of typological identification with Israel being called out of Egypt. Ultimately, Joseph and Mary and Jesus come out of Egypt. Israel passes through the water. Jesus is baptized. Israel is then tested in the wilderness. Jesus is likewise tested following the baptism. So there's a lot of rich associations with our understanding of Jesus as the Son of God in the Gospel of Matthew. He is the faithful Son of God, fulfills the type found in Israel as God's Son, called to carry out God's purpose. Wherein Israel failed, Jesus succeeds, bringing the long history of God's dealing with his people to an ultimate fulfillment, bringing it along toward ultimate fulfillment, we should say. And you might notice that the first public confession of Jesus' divine sonship comes only after the death of Jesus, highlighting this as the climactic affirmation of that divine sonship. If you want to know what it's about, you've got to see it in the light of the cross. Once again, the Gospels, as theological narratives, have to be read backwards, so to speak. The Passion helps us to make sense of it all. Now, there are a number of other titles. We've already referred to some of them. Son of David and Christ, strongly messianic titles. Once again, these titles and the use of them in the Gospel of Matthew are heavily nuanced by the unfolding of the story of Jesus' life. We talked about how Jesus' identity as Son of David is somewhat ambiguous in the Gospel of Matthew. There's a resistance to any embracing of triumphalistic, militaristic associations related to the title Son of David. Instead, as Son of David, he is the humble servant who heals people who don't amount to much. And in one case, the Canaanite woman stand outside of Israel, the lost sheep who are not of Israel. Jesus is also presented as a son of Abraham. This comes early on in the Gospel of Matthew in the genealogy. There's little doubt in my mind that this way of presenting Jesus foreshadows the blessing of the nations and this whole business of the Gentiles and the church and the relationship between Jew and Gentile. You've got a tension here between the particular call of Abraham and the universal blessing of the nations. And this is reinforced by the worship of Jesus by the foreign wise men who come to Bethlehem, the declaration by John the Baptist that God is able from these stones to raise up children to Abraham, the faith of the centurion, the first person to be held up as a model of faith in the Gospel of Matthew, is a Roman centurion in the 8th chapter. It's a Roman centurion who makes this public confession of Jesus' true divine sonship in the wake of the crucifixion of Jesus in the 27th chapter, verse 54. And then finally, this gospel ends with a commission to disciple the nations, 28:19. Jesus, son of Abraham, particularly called by God, yet not only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but for the blessing of the nations. Jesus is also presented in the Gospel of Matthew as the returning and reigning Son of Man, Judge, King over all the earth. We might relate the title Lord here at this point, and Matthew's use of the title Lord. There are definite nuances of usage when compared with Mark. In the Gospel of Mark, everyone tends to call Jesus teacher. The opponents, those who encounter Jesus but do not follow, those who encounter and believe in him, the disciples, they tend to call him teacher. On the other hand, Mark never has disciples or opponents call Jesus Lord. Only the afflicted do so. But for Matthew, always outsiders call Jesus teacher. Opponents such as scribes, Pharisees, Jewish tax collectors, Herodians, Sadducees, those who encounter but do not follow. Jesus is never called teacher by a disciple, by the afflicted, or those coming to faith. Instead, the disciples and those coming to faith in Jesus call him Lord. From within the circle of discipleship, people hear Jesus' words as those of Lord, or God with us, as one filled with all authority. Now, there's an apparent exception to the rule of usage of the title Lord in Matthew. But the exception confirms it. Judas the betrayer addresses Jesus as teacher, not Lord, only reinforcing a sense of his own outsider status as far as the purposes of God are concerned. But people generally, the believers, the disciples, they consistently refer to Jesus as Lord and as Master. Again, we need to affirm that the use of all of these titles, and there are many others we could go into, but we just try to highlight some of the most significant ones. But the use of all of these is heavily nuanced by the narrative framework of the Gospel of Matthew, by the outcome of the story, the passion narrative. We don't fully understand who Jesus is as Son of God, Son of Man, returning, reigning, Judge, King, Lord, Son of David. Any of these titles we do not fully understand except in light of the cross and in light of a ministry that is shaped by the cross, that moves toward the cross. Another way we could look at the Christology of the Gospel of Matthew, in addition to the titles, is the activity of Jesus, what Jesus does. Interestingly enough, teaching is his most prominent activity, even though it's only the outsiders who refer to him with this title. Within Matthew's theological frame, Jesus is not just a rabbi from the past, however, giving instructions to the church. Instead, he is teacher precisely as Lord of the church. And this is probably why we have this theological emphasis upon Jesus as the presence of God. God with us. Lo, I am with you always. Wherever two or three are gathered, there am I in the midst. In the presentation of Jesus in Matthew's Gospel, we are faced with the living Lord of the church, who in his teaching, who in every aspect of his public ministry, is the one present with God's people, present as Lord and Redeemer. And in the activity of this ministry, we find all kinds of things going on. The miracles of Jesus, they are acts of compassion and mercy, logically related to the supreme act of compassion and mercy, the giving of Jesus, giving of himself in death, the ministry of suffering and death, and ultimately resurrection from the dead. There are numerous encounters and controversies that reveal something of the person and work of Christ. Some of those perhaps are best dealt with under the category of Christology. So the activity of Christ is rife with significance as to Matthew's presentation of the person and work of Christ. And along with the titles and the activity, we could identify recurrent themes, and we've already talked about some of these. The theme of fulfillment and salvation history. Matthew is big on Jesus as the fulfillment of the Old Testament. There's a lot of typology, some of it very explicit, some of it more subtle. This took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken, Matthew comes right out and says. And the Old Testament provides certain interpretive keys to understanding what the life and ministry of Jesus is all about. And Jesus is presented unequivocally as the fulfillment of all of redemptive history. One of the more interesting and significant applications of the theme of fulfillment in Matthew's presentation of Jesus concerns Jesus and the law. Again, here the key is fulfillment. You have two extremes that Matthew seems to be addressing in this gospel, between antinomianism or anti-law and legalism as represented by the Pharisees. And through the theme of fulfillment, Matthew tries, I think, to resolve this tension in his presentation of the person and ministry of Jesus. Please turn now to side B of the tape.